Hey, welcome back, everybody. Time again for this weekly journey we call Living Hope, designed to provide hope, inspiration, and education for those living with pancreatic cancer, sharing the real-life stories of those really affected by this deadly disease and how they deal with it on a daily basis. Or in today's case, the wonderful people, the good people behind the scenes trying to give us hope and inspiration and maybe a chance to some early detections that we're talking about here today, Roberta.
Yes, we are. We have Dr. Michael DeMuir from Hoag. He's the Director of Precision Medicine. And it's all we're going to talk about early cancer detection and the high-risk program. So I'm really happy to have you here today and really talk about it. I'm really excited to do this. So thank you for coming. We appreciate it. And I hope you didn't have too long of a drive getting here.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Can I start by just asking one question we heard all the time?
Yeah, sure.
And Roberta says this all the time. Is the secret to higher survival rates, which are now at, what, 13%, only 13% or something like that?
Yeah, 13 right now.
Is the secret, part of the secret, early detection? Because by the time I recognize I got this, or they realize, because the pancreas is hidden and I don't know and it has other symptoms that could mimic something else, is that what's been missing in this whole fight, or better early detection?
That's a huge part of it, because most of the time, yeah, there are no symptoms until it's already metastasized. So most people present with advanced disease, and then it's very hard to cure, so if possible at all. So our best chance for long-term survival is to pick it up early, which is why we're trying to do early detection, much like mammograms and breast cancer. We can very often cure it if we catch it small, and there we have very effective screening.
Yeah, I remember the days long ago that prostate cancer, they had a low survival rate the way we did, the way pancreatic cancer does. But then when they came up with that blood test, that just turned everything around so quickly to now where they have a really high, I think it's 98% survival rate. So that's awesome. That's something I think we need for pancreatic cancer as well.
Yeah, completely agree with you on that. So
we hear the term precision medicine. Can you explain to us in layman's terms what people can understand exactly what that is and what it entails?
Yeah, sure. We know every cancer is not the same. Really, it's an outgrowth of the Human Genome Project. So the human genome was sequenced in around 2002 and 2003, recently completed, but largely sequenced. And so the goal of precision medicine was to take the technology of being able to sequence DNA, assess the genetic code of the cancer, and then, based on that information, find drugs that are more targeted, like a lock and a key approach, where, you know, rather than carpet bombing with a chemotherapy that gives a lot of toxicity, if you had a drug that was very specific to the particular DNA mutation in a tumor, that you could have a drug that was more effective but also have less side effects. So the field of precision medicine was really identifying those gene mutations, spurring the development of new drugs that are targeted, and then getting better outcomes for our patients.
So how would you take like a sample of the tumor cell and then try it, experiment with some of the other drugs? How does that actually work?
Yeah, so in a way, there was an old assay called the clonogenic assay, where they would try to grow tumor cells in a petri dish, basically, and then, much like you do with antibiotics and bacteria, you would treat different drugs and see which ones work. And that's still used, that approach is still used in drug discovery, but from a precision medicine, we rely on being able to sequence the DNA. And part of what made that useful is, after the Human Genome Project, is the technology became less expensive. You know, in the old days, it would cost a lot of money to be able to sequence a tumor. Now we can do it for a few thousand dollars and insurance covers it, but we get the genetic information on a particular tumor and we have more drugs. The other thing is, it happens now very quickly. The Human Genome Project took over a decade, whereas now we get the answer from sequencing a patient's tumor in a couple weeks. So we get the answer back. We can analyze what are the genetic drivers, the mutations that are causing the tumor cells to grow. And in some cancers, the success rate of finding those drivers is quite high. Like in lung cancer, it can be 40 or 50% of tumors have a particular driver that we have drugs that can be effective at treating it. Not as common in in pancreas cancer, but we see some of those for sure.
So when a patient comes in, then do you just take blood work from it?
Ideally, you get a sample of the tumor. Now, it can be done with a biopsy under CAT scan guidance. You can sample some, and you do it on the amount of tissue you can get from a needle biopsy. Or now we're able to do blood tests and pick up DNA from tumor that's circulating in the blood. That's tumor shed DNA into the bloodstream, and we can isolate that. It's usually preferable to get tumor if we can, but when we can't, then we can use circulating tumor DNA.
Yeah, because I know I was looking into it, but my doctor didn't feel being able to take a sample of the tumor was really a good idea for me. So then the next answer would be the blood test then.
Yeah.
And we know that early detection is critical, but how does that impact patient outcomes?
So we had a research trial at Hoag thinking that this was going to be a good idea. And we were enrolling patients either because they had a strong family history of pancreas cancer, or we knew that they had an inherited gene mutation, something you can get from your parents, or something like Angelina Jolie made famous BRCA1 and 2, that increases your risk for not only breast cancer, but ovarian cancer and pancreas cancer, and in men, prostate cancer. If we know patients have that, we're also screening them. So the screening is most effective in patients that are at increased risk for tumor. So we were doing endoscopic ultrasound. They put a scope down the stomach like a GI doc would do, and then ultrasound through the back wall of the stomach and get a very detailed look at the pancreas, can pick up small tumors, or MRI of the pancreas, and we're alternating that. We did include blood tests, including like CA19-9, which hasn't been really shown to be a good screening test for pancreas cancer, but it is used in surveillance of patients with cancer. But we were doing that prospectively and monitoring patients. Now there are consortiums, the big ones PRECEDE, and everybody's pooling their data together to learn how we can best screen patients and find out the results of screening better. There was a trial called the CAPS-5 study that was run out of Johns Hopkins, but included the 9 university medical centers, and they screened over 1,400 patients and monitored them and detected. Now, the patients that they detected pancreas cancer in 9 of patients, and 7 of them were stage 1. Those 9 overall able to have surgery, and their 5-year survival was 73%. The median survival was almost 10 years compared to patients who were found not through the screening program or the early detection program, where median survival was 1.5 years. So big difference in terms of being able to identify at-risk patients through screening, find small early tumors that are surgically resectable. That's still our best hope. But when that study was published, then we at Hoag said, well, we think this is standard of care. We are doing it. We have over 300 patients who are following on prospective screening program at Hoag for early detection. We've picked up a couple patients with pancreas cancer that have been early, and we've been able to do surgery and resect their tumors.
How often do you do the screening?
The protocol is every year, and we start with endoscopic ultrasound, I mentioned MRI and blood test on year 1, and then we alternate blood test every year, but we alternate every other year MRI and endoscopic ultrasound. Yeah, it's a yearly appointment when you come in and you get your tests.
And what defines someone as high risk for developing pancreatic cancer?
Either family history, and particularly first-degree relatives. So if you have 3 family members, they're high risk, and I think Chelsea would have spoken to you about that last week, our genetic counselor that was here with you. But yeah, if there's a family history, or if you have one of certain genes that I mentioned, BRCA1 or 2, or ATM is another one, but there's certain genes that we know are associated, that if you inherit those genes and that is part of your genetic makeup that we can identify with genetic testing, that you're at increased risk.
Can you walk us through Hoag's high-risk pancreatic cancer program a little bit more in detail?
Yeah, so we, as I said, we're now part of the PRECEDE consortium, we're doing what they recommend. But as I mentioned, they come in, usually you'll either see me or we have a nurse practitioner now that is helping, because it's a lot of patients and I have other duties, and keeps track of everybody. And we get the blood test. First, we examine them, get patients come in, get an examination, we talk to you about the risk factors and why we screen and all those things. And then we get the blood tests and the endoscopic ultrasound and the MRI, and then follow again on a yearly basis. But it's also important to remember other things. There are lifestyle things that can be done, keeping your healthy weight, just because you're at increased risk for pancreas cancer doesn't mean you can't get breast cancer or colon cancer. So you got to get your mammography, get your colonoscopy, and do all the other health screening. Keep your blood pressure under control, your cholesterol. Just because you're screening for one thing doesn't mean you get a free pass on everything else. So we want to make sure people are following up. We also know that some of these gene mutations could predispose you to other cancers. So the pancreas cancer works in close, or program people work in close collaboration with, we have a breast cancer screening program, an ovarian screening program, we have a skin cancer melanoma screening program. So depending on the inherited mutation the patient may have or their family history, they may be in more than one high-risk program.
Sounds like Hoag might offer the one-stop program where you can go in and get maybe checked for everything.
That's the goal, is to coordinate. Yeah, and one of the reasons we hired Nisha, our nurse practitioner, was to coordinate so that patients aren't getting multiple overlapping tests and things like that, but to try to streamline the screening efforts across different programs.
Yeah, because just checking for pancreatic cancer, the testing is very invasive. It's not simple just going to get the blood test and that's it.
MRI takes time and you're in the tube, but it's not invasive. The endoscopic ultrasound you do, it's a day procedure and you're sedated and they put the scope down into your stomach. But again, it's the advantage of that is if they see something, they can do a little needle biopsy at the same time right through the scope. And we have very skilled endoscopic ultrasound physicians at our place.
Do you know, and this is, I can't answer, I don't know, but when I was first diagnosed, what they did the MRI first, and then they did the ultrasound, is that pretty, or the scope going down into the stomach, is that still pretty much, or can they just detect it mainly with an MRI?
MRI can show you a mass lesion in the pancreas, but it doesn't get you tissue, so the endoscopic ultrasound can be done for further evaluation, but also I mentioned you can do a biopsy, so it's important to get a biopsy because adenocarcinoma is the pancreas cancer most people know and talk about. It's 95% of them, but there are a small percentage of patients that have other type of tumors like neuroendocrine tumors. Famous would be Steve Jobs. I didn't take care of him, but it's pretty widely reported that's what he had, as a neuroendocrine tumor. So that's a little different tumor, different treatments. It's actually been a subspecialty interest of mine because my training was in endocrine surgery.
Excuse me. Yeah, that's what my mom was diagnosed and died with, peanuts, and my dad was the more aggressive, the PDAC, and I present with both. So it's been a little trying sometimes with treatment. Do you see that very often, the combination of the two types?
Not often. Occasionally you do. Peanuts can be quite variable in terms of that. And even if you do autopsies on patients that have died in a car accident at age 80 or something, it's not uncommon to find small peanuts in there. But just much if you do autopsies on 80-year-old men, there's little pancreas, I'm sorry, little prostate cancers that never bothered them and wouldn't have unless they lived to 150 or something, who knows. But they're treated completely differently. We have different drugs. And again, the molecular understanding of the two tumors shows us that they're really distinct. They come from different cells, but they have different treatments, different drugs. We have radiopharmaceuticals now that are used to treat the peanuts or the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors that are shown to be effective, things as well.
Yeah, it's been very interesting, to say the least. How is precision medicine changing the way we approach pancreatic cancer prevention and treatment?
The biggest one, as you mentioned, is identifying the patients that have inherited mutations that'll tell you you're at increased risk. And then it helps define the risk and helps define maybe other cancers as well. So that's the one. Then if you have pancreas cancer and we identify particular mutations, it may help guide the chemotherapy choice or maintenance therapy choice, and even tell us, for example, that you might be at increased risk for toxicity from a particular drug. If you inherit a specific kind of, I will say it's a SNP variation, I want to say it's abnormality, a variation in your pharmacogenetics, it's your metabolism of drugs, you may be more sensitive to 5-FU, and even if you have a particular inherited genotype, if you will, of DPYD is the gene, that getting 5-FU could be very toxic and could be even fatal. So we would maybe not pick a 5-FU-based therapy. You might go with gemcitabine-based protocol or something.
Yeah, that 5-FU is perfectly named as well. I'm sorry.
Some people don't like it. That's true.
It can be a very difficult drug to use. But yeah, like I said, I can't complain too much because I'm still here. So that's good. How do doctors actually then figure out what care or treatment is right for the patient?
That's where the precision medicine comes in, is the interpretation of the genome material. So we mentioned sending it off now. There's commercial vendors that'll do the sequencing. Most places we do use a commercial vendor. Certain universities will have their own in-house sequencing labs, but the commercial vendors do a great job. We get the results back in a couple weeks, and then we have the results to review. And then you have to remember that when most of the medical oncologists now, they're older. The human genome hadn't even been sequenced, so the technology is still pretty new, 20 years old, where we're in the widespread use is less than that, maybe 10 years, the widespread use of sequencing of patients' tumors. We help, our job is to help doctors interpret those results, and that's what the Precision Medicine Program does, is we're available for consultation to the doctors. And very often, for example, we'll sequence a patient's tumor and we'll see a mutation that says, this could be inherited, so let's send the patient to our genetic counselors. Say we saw BRCA2 in the tumor, because it's in every cell in the body, it'll be in the tumor as well. Someone will say, we'll send the patient off to have a blood test to do genetic testing, and then we'll find out that's inherited. And then, not only that, then we can screen family members and then maybe identify additional people at high risk. So that it's a possibility that if a patient has cancer, that then their relatives may find out that they're also at increased risk, and maybe we can help them by detecting the cancer early.
Do you see that when this happens that the family members are more than willing to come in and get tested, or is there some hesitation there?
I would say most are willing to get tested, but sometimes people don't want to know. So that's true, and we can't force people to do something they don't want to do, but yeah. So we do see that sometimes, but again, if we know that we can detect something early and then potentially save somebody's life, it's a pretty good argument for doing it.
Yeah, it almost sounds like really the benefit is better to come in than not. But
we think so.
Do you ever get any reasons why people don't want to do it? They just don't want to know, and they just want to let fate deal whatever hand it has?
Yeah, we do. Some people don't get their blood pressure checked, or I feel fine, I just don't want to go to the doctor. They'll find something. We hear that.
Yeah, I've been told if you talk about it, then that means I'm going to get it. So we don't even want to talk about it, which obviously we know it's not contagious that way, right? You talked earlier briefly about, I heard the word about insurance. So insurance would cover something like this?
With the screening now, with the NCCN guidelines, the National Cancer Cooperative Network, you know, that issues recommendations, are pretty widely respected by at least oncologists, and we follow them for treatment protocols. They do now recommend screening, and it's in the guidelines. So every once in a while, we'll have a little trouble with the insurance, where we call up and have to file an appeal and get what they call a peer-to-peer, where I have to talk to a doctor that, you know, works for the insurance company and explain, and we'll say, it's in the NCCN guidelines. Are you telling us we can't do it? And they usually go, oh, okay, we'll approve it. So just to make you jump through some hoops sometimes. But yeah, we usually get it approved. Patients still have to have co-pays and deductibles and all that, which, you know, we can't control. But yeah.
For them maybe not wanting to pay for it, is it because they don't understand what it is? They don't know what the rules are? Or why wouldn't an insurance company want to cover it? Or do you even know? Can well, I even answer that? Do you even want to answer that question?
I can. I can assign sinister motives, but I don't want to. They're in business, and obviously, I think that gets to be a very complicated discussion. But preventative care is a long-term thing. There's a lot of good studies that show the average patient's on a particular insurance company for maybe less than 4 years. So, if you do that math, is long-term? Are they playing the long-term game, or are they looking for short-term cost savings in terms of patients' outcomes and stuff like that? Yeah, I don't really know. I'm not in the insurance business, so yeah, I can only guess.
And I think we all probably guess about the same, but yeah, it's fine. Sorry, don't want to put you on the spot. It's just a lot of people do ask, what about insurance? It's something to consider.
Most of the time we're able to get coverage for these procedures and things like that, so it's a matter of the co-pays and deductibles, which are not insignificant nowadays for a lot of people.
Because I can just remember, and this is on genetic testing, just getting that done years ago was so expensive, whereas now it's really come down quite a bit.
Chelsea would have told you, maybe, I don't know, that we're the testing from a lot of companies is like a few hundred dollars at most. It's really, that should not be a cost barrier for most people, particularly in Orange County, where it's a fairly affluent area. So it shouldn't be a barrier.
Yeah. So if someone doesn't have any known risk factors, is precision medicine still something they should think about?
I think in terms of if you have cancer, yeah, for a lot of patients, particularly if chemotherapy is a consideration or the tumor is more advanced, yeah, then sequencing the patient's tumor becomes very important. And so anybody with an advanced or recurrent cancer, for the most part, should have sequencing of their tumor, especially if it doesn't respond to chemotherapy, the standard chemotherapy, but definitely because you want to find, sometimes a tumor has a mutation, so 1 in 100 of that particular type of cancer. But if you find it, it's a huge impact for that patient because you may have a very effective therapy. All patients with stage 4 pancreas cancer, now we recommend having genetic counseling and testing because, again, we may find something like a BRCA that would then have an impact not only on the patient and potential chemotherapy decisions, but also on screening family members or screening for other cancers in that patient.
And then how do people find out about precision medicine? How do they find you? Is it always from their doctor or can they find you on their own somehow?
We work as a support for our medical oncologists. We're not really doing individual consults on the precision medicine side for patients, but we work through their oncologists because we're not going to substitute our opinion for the oncologist. The oncologists know the patient's treatment history, know what other diseases they have going on, maybe what other drugs are going on, and all that becomes important in making treatment decisions. So we work best in consultation with the patient's oncologists. So we at Hoag also have tumor boards where if patients have a cancer, their cases are presented with these multidisciplinary tumor boards, and we have over 30 a month. Every week we have a GI, includes pancreas. Every other week, thyroid, which I host once a month. We have molecular tumor board to highlight particular precision medicine cases, and lung cancers once a week, various things, neuro, which brain tumors is once a week. So we have a bunch of breast cancer once a week, too. So we have all these tumor boards, and then what happens is the patients are presented, their case history is presented by the doctor to the other doctors in the group of all the different specialties related to cancer, and then the x-rays are showed, the pathology images are shown, and then the case is discussed regarding making treatment decisions. And then we'll present as part of that the molecular findings and then how that might impact on the case. And we may say, there's a patient that has a mutation that could be germline, so we recommend referral to the genetic counselor. And so sometimes that's how that all gets done. That's commonly done at Hoag. I'll say that type of integration is not common. Even at a lot of universities, you don't see that kind of integrated support.
Yeah, so does every patient then, does their case go to the tumor board, or what distinguishes that?
I would say most patients' cases get presented. I can't say that systematically they all do, but I would say the majority of our patients at Hoag do get presented at a tumor board during the course of their treatment. Yeah.
And is that just to get different ideas and opinions on how to treat, or what's the purpose of doing that?
Sometimes it's to bring in different ideas, different options, get people's different perspectives, everybody, more brains than one looking at it, and they go, oh, I didn't think about that, or bring in different areas of expertise. So that's a big part of it. And the other part of it is to coordinate so that docs are saying, for example, a patient recently had thyroid cancer and said, I did surgery for recurrence, and we decided the patient needs additional treatment. And the medical oncologist, the nuclear medicine doctor, and I coordinated the plans for the additional treatment through the tumor board. So we agreed on a course, and then we have pretty prescribed roles on how we do that because we've done it before, but we work together to chart the course for that patient.
Are there any promising or new technologies or approaches on the horizon that give you hope that you can talk about a little bit?
Yeah, look, I think research is happening all the time. The genetics has been a big leap forward, but I think our advances are coming in newer drugs that come as a result. So the new technologies in developing drugs, and then we have several clinical trials. I think there's a lot of promise in the, I'll just say, tumor vaccine area, but engineered immune cells, the CAR T, we talked a little bit before about CAR NK natural killer cells or genetically engineered immune cells to try to fight tumors, different approaches that way. Putting treatments together and sequencing them differently, chemotherapy or chemotherapy and radiation before surgery in pancreas cancer, then whether additional chemotherapy or not. The different sequencing and combinations of drugs, there's incremental progress. I would say it's not, aha, we've got the cure. All of a sudden, we go from 0 to 100, we got the cure. But we're making incremental progress. I think the early detection interest has really been something. One of the projects that we had, it was very interesting, and I think has some hope down the road. We did a project where we had patients with pancreas cancer, but because they're from the area, we had old CAT scans. Say they had appendicitis a few years ago, and so we looked at old CAT scans, and the pancreas was reported as normal, but using, I'll say, AI light, artificial intelligence, but it was called radiomics, a way of using the computer to see what the eye can't see, saw some differences in those pancreas in some of those patients. And we looked at the pilot set of 23 patients, but we're doing a project now where we've got a larger set of 50 tumors with an astronomer at Caltech. And he's looking at using his computer things, and he tracks, use computer to track digital images of the space, objects in space. Well, CAT scans are digital images, so he's got a grad student looking at our pancreas cancer images and his patients to see if there's something. And I can see that maybe something subtle in the pancreas could automate, every time patient gets a CAT scan, it might be just embedded in the software of the CAT scanner to run this AI look at the pancreas and say, there's a pancreas you ought to worry about and maybe keep track of closely, so that maybe we'll get that kind of thing in the future. So AI is helping perhaps in review of radiology, but also is being used to help speed drug development. So there's a lot of promise in some of their newer technologies that are out there.
Yeah, that AI is really amazing. It's a little scary, too, to be honest.
It is. It's the yin and the yang. Yeah, there's a lot of potential good, but yeah, we all saw the old Terminator movies where AI was killing off the human race. We don't want that either.
No, but like I said, it can be a little scary, but it's very informative. I've been using it a lot. Yeah. It's really hesitant, but it's been really amazing.
I use it, too. Yeah.
Can you share a little bit about your journey into precision medicine and what led you to focus on pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, I mentioned my training is in endocrine surgery, and so I got particular interest in the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Early days of surgery residency, I became interested in oncology. We're doing big operations, have really impact on patients. And so then I was interested in staying in academics, so I had some research training, and I went to UC San Francisco, and the doctor there was working on thyroid cancer, and that got my path started. Then I went to Milwaukee as a junior faculty and assistant associate professor there, and had a research lab, and we did a lot of pancreas cancer surgery there, and I used to do the Whipple procedures and all that. And again, you try to learn about what you're seeing the patients. Patients are our best teachers, so we would take the operative samples and we would analyze them in the lab. We were looking at different things, and so I was doing a lot of pancreas cancer research there. When I was there, I brought in, and I hadn't been doing it, but there were some studies about using radiation after the Whipple procedure to try to get better outcomes, reduce the risk the tumor would come back. And we started that back then. That was in the early 90s. And then from there, I went to University of Arizona, back there as a professor of surgery, and I was doing a lot of pancreas cancer surgery there, and I was collaborating with the cancer center director, Dr. Von Hoff, very well-known medical oncologist in pancreas cancer. But in around that time, it was in around the early 2000s, TGen started up in Phoenix, Translational Genomics Research Institute. And Dr. Trent there, Jeff Trent, was high up, and he was one of the guys that helped do the Human Genome Project along with Francis Collins at the NIH. And he came from Arizona and came to Phoenix to start the Translational Genomics Research Institute. And this is a private nonprofit institute that was basically designed to try to take the technology from the Human Genome Project and get it to patients. And obviously there was a cancer focus as well as focus in other diseases like Alzheimer's and brain neurologic disorders, but really a lot of effort. And Dr. Von Hoff started going up to work with Dr. Trent, and together they helped form TGen. And then he dragged me up there. I was going up there a day a week for a few years. Yeah. From Tucson to Phoenix, 100 miles of a very boring drive, but doing that every week. And then eventually I went up to Phoenix full time, and I was involved with TGen as well as having a clinical practice in Scottsdale. And then along the way, I got my MBA. I was at the University of Arizona, and I got my MBA there. And then TGen started a spinoff company to do sequencing patients' tumors to help guide therapy and the whole idea of early days of precision medicine. And I was roped in to help start with that company. And that's how I got into precision medicine, because all the stuff we were doing in the lab to analyze DNA and sequencing was then getting into patients. And so that's how I got into the precision medicine, really through my association with TJ.
Well, I'm really glad that you got roped in. And I wish we could continue more, because like I told you, the time goes by so quickly, and I really do
appreciate it. It's over already? Wow.
Yeah, see, so we can have you come back maybe and talk more, because like I said, there's so much more to talk about. And it's very interesting, and I would just love it, because you're really great at getting into a layman's term where people can understand it. So I do thank you for coming, and again, would love to have you come back at another time and spend more time with you. So thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me, Roberta.
You're welcome. Thank you. As long as you speak my name, I shall live forever, is dedicated to Diane Fry.
There you have it. Another great reason to tune in each and every time to Living Hope. Your journey with pancreatic cancer, as we share some hope and inspiration ideas about this dangerous journey. And for those who didn't write it down, let's give you that number one more time. There is a place now that you can find more about early detection and high-risk programs. And I'm going to give you that site. So you ready? Precede Study. Sounds pretty simple. PRECEDE study.org. Visit that. See if there's an early detection program near you. And either way, we hope you'll come back and detect our next episode here on Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live.